We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I am delighted to be joined by Ian Mulhern, the Executive Director for UK Policy and Chief Economist for the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. Welcome to the podcast, Ian.
Hi, Will. Great to be with you.
So in this episode, we're going to be discussing a piece that you've written for the Institute, Lockdown Lessons, Five Steps That Should Guide the UK's New Roadmap. And to begin with, I'd like to ask you about a statistic that particularly stood out to me, quite a stark statistic. In the piece, you mentioned that two-thirds of COVID-19-related deaths have occurred since September. So my first question is, why do you think that's happened, and what do you think that that says about the government's response?
Well, it's a good question, Will. I mean, I think what we faced this week with the government's new plan to exit lockdown was almost a rerun of what we had, last May, when the country was coming out of its first lockdown, and everybody was looking to see what sort of plan the government would put forward. But of course, as you suggest, and as that number suggests, whatever strategy it was that the government was seeking to follow after May last year, it didn't really work, and things slipped out of control, as we all know, in the autumn. Cases mounted, and here we are in another heavy lockdown. So I think what it tells us is that for whatever reason, that exit strategy didn't work. So it's critically important that we at least look back and try and work out why it didn't work before we sort of figure out what to do this time.
And one of the things that the piece suggests as to why it didn't work is the fact that the Joint Biosecurity Centre's alert system has not been linked to the tier system that the government implemented. Why do you think that they didn't make that link, which would seem, particularly in light of reading your piece, a fairly obvious link to make?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, if you go back to what the Prime Minister said on the 11th of May, I think it's the 11th of May, when he spoke about the exit from lockdown, he announced the setting up of this Joint Biosecurity Centre as an expert body to judge the alert level according to the sort of prevalence of the virus and the rate of spread that we were seeing. And the implication was that would govern, in fact, the Prime Minister said directly that would govern the degree to which restrictions were imposed. But over the summer, as case numbers fell and things started to get back to relative normality, there was no kind of formal link between those alert levels and any set of restrictions the government might introduce. So that when the cases started rising again and the JBC changed its alert level, there was no sort of automatic trigger or association with restrictions. Why was that the case? I think it's hard to know, really. I mean, to some degree, I think it was just a gap in the strategy. There was a sort of crossing the fingers and hoping that it was all over and we could just get out of it kind of approach. So the clearly expressed intention of the Prime Minister then wasn't followed through because there was no clear link established in the exit plan. So I think that's the salutary lesson. If things sort of start going quite well over the next few months and everybody thinks it's all over, then, are we going to be back in the same situation? I think there's another reason, though, why possibly no explicit link was made. And that's that, a feature of the government's response throughout has been that it's wanted to retain flexibility. And I think there's some in its response and make decisions at the time. There's some valid reasons for that, but there's also some problems with that and that it can encourage a lot of dither and delay when things start to go wrong. And I think, that ties into a further point that we raise in the paper, that you know, particularly from the Treasury side, there was a sort of underestimation of the economic implications of letting the virus get out of control, really. And so the Treasury was always pulling back on the need to implement restrictions. And so, in a sense, that Treasury pressure meant that the lack of a link between the alert level and the restrictions turned into, you know, holding off too long and then having to act much more strongly later, which is why we're in this lockdown.
Mm. And on the point of the Treasury, of course, in the next week, we're going to be seeing a March budget or a March economic plan from the Chancellor. What do you think is going to be central to that plan? Do you think it's just going to be a case of ensuring that the there's enough money going into the economy and into supporting businesses? And what impact do you think that that's going to have on the lockdown? Because as you mentioned there, the Treasury throughout this process seems to have been somewhat reluctant to do anything that would impact business negatively, like the lockdowns. Do you think that this March budget is going to have any impact on the restrictions that we're currently under?
Well, I think it's obviously hard to know exactly what's going to be in it, but I think the, you know, the noises that we're getting is that, you know, there will be some extensions to support and that kind of thing. And the Treasury's done very well in some aspects of the crisis, you know, particularly the furlough scheme and other things like that. I mean, there are gaps, but, you know, on the whole, it's been pretty good. And so I think that extension of the short-term support will be there, which is going to be important. And so that's welcome to see. I think what we lack, again, is it's a bit of a one-way ticket again. It sounds like there'll be plans to phase out the current levels of support. There won't really be any kind of framework for thinking about, well, what if, say, a certain area of the country faces an outbreak and we need to clamp down it? Will there be any support provided for those areas, and on what basis? So, you know, it's kind of like I think they're, again, very much planning on the basis that this is going to be over pretty soon. And that may or may not be a good basis to plan, but it certainly didn't work last time. Obviously, things are a bit different this time with the vaccine, but still, it's probably not the ideal way to approach it.
On the point of easing restrictions, one of the main arguments in the piece that you've written is that the either tightening or loosening of restrictions should be based on data that is provided, and it should be data-led and work very much with the JBC. And one of the problems in terms of implementing the restrictions and the lockdown has been the interplay between national authorities and regional governance. Do you think that part of the reason that we've had this problems between national government and local government has been because of a certain amount of political grandstanding from either side that have wanted to take the lead in their particular area, or in the case of the government, wanting to stamp its mark of authority over the whole country? And this has resulted in a worse implementation of restrictions than otherwise if the government and local government had worked more closely together.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, it's clear that there have been those tussles, and some of them for very legitimate reasons and others for perhaps less legitimate reasons, some aspects of it. But I think the thing to take away from it is that because there was no, you know, in the autumn, the government was trying to stitch up ad hoc support for local areas, you know, on the hoof. And inevitably, if you're going to do things that complicated in that kind of quick turnaround time frame, and it's highly political, obviously, you're talking about people's livelihoods and people's lives here, you know, it's going to deteriorate, and then you're going to face these kind of clashes. So it's all the more reason to have set out a full comprehensive strategy for how we intend to deal with these things in any set of circumstances that might arise, rather than essentially crossing our fingers and hoping for the best. And so, you know, I think it was, again, that kind of the lack of any plan, so they almost hadn't war gamed any of these potential second wave or whatever. And so we're really caught on the hoof. And that was the cause, I think, of a lot of the political battles that then ensued.
And on the point of the political battles that ensued, one of the issues that we have seen is that people perhaps in more rural areas have complained, why are we in a particular tier when we don't have in this particular part of this region, a high amount of transmission compared to other areas that have higher amounts of transmission. There's been lots of arguments relating to population density. And in fact, a few months ago, you had Conservative MPs, perhaps slightly ridiculously in London, arguing, well, why is this particular borough under this level of restrictions when the borough that I represent isn't? Do you think that devolving restrictions based on population density is an idea that is too micromanagerial in terms of attempting to combat the virus and wouldn't work? Or do you think that perhaps working on a more micro level might help in establishing better links in terms of chain of transmission from one individual to another?
So I think, so I guess the context here is that obviously in the last exit strategy, we had a, you know, system of kind of local interventions, you know, starting with Leicester back in July time. And then, of course, you know, stretching out to, you know, Greater Manchester and Liverpool and various other places. So, you know, we saw that kind of local variation in restrictions in the last one, in last exit. And of course, this time the government has essentially tried to avoid that and said, look, it didn't really work and we don't really want to do that. So we're going to, the whole country is going to exit at once. And that's, I think, the context for this. I think in terms of, our view is that that is not a very sensible way to go. Now, it's always the case, as you kind of imply in a question, that there's going to be perceived unfairnesses. If you get to sort of local area restrictions, there's always going to be some area that's apparently at you know, outside the net, and or, you know, you cross the road and you're in a different set of restrictions. So that's always going to be the case, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't strive for at least a more sensible and reasonable approach to these things. And I think we're already seeing the emergence across the country of some of the problems with having a one-size-fits-all policy. Much of the north, the Midlands and the north, we're seeing rates of infection at the moment that are twice those in the south, the greatest southeast and southwest. And also numbers are falling much faster in the greater southeast as well. So, you know, what we're going to see if trends continue within a couple of weeks is that case numbers in the in outside the southeast are going to be many multiples potentially of those in the south. Now, of course, all that could change, but it just goes to show that, you know, if you are if you're just taking a one size fits all policy to the ending restrictions, the likelihood is that, you know, for half the country it's going to be too soon to lift restrictions, and for half the country it's going to be too late. And that means unnecessary either lost lives or lost livelihoods. And so that doesn't make much sense. And I think most people would understand that, you know, regional flexibility or local flexibility is a sensible step to kind of get out of this with the minimum damage being done.
We're now going to take a short break from our discussion with Ian Mulhern to hear a trailer for the Politics of Sound podcast. When we come back, I will be discussing with Ian Mulhern vaccination in the UK as compared to the EU, domestic versus international vaccine passports, and the long-term effects of the pandemic, what impact it will have on statutory sick pay, and many other things. See you in a moment.
Do you want to see your politicians from a different angle? It's time for the Politics of Sound podcast. I believe that people's record collections can reveal a lot about them, and so every month I invite politicians and political figures to reveal their three all-time favourite albums, and in exchange, I want to know all about them and their lives, what they think, and why they think it. My guest for the March episode is Lawrence Fox.
I've always thought what I think.
No, I'm not sorry. I do believe it. And you know what? I believe it even more today than I did.
I think Twitter's a sewer.
I'm sorry, that's not how democracy works.
Oh, God, who said it? I've gone woke.
And it's not like I was saying anything controversial.
The Politics of Sound podcast with my guest, Lawrence Fox, out March the 1st on Global Player or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the paper, you propose a framework of systems of linked tiers and alerts, and there are five alert levels. The highest alert level, level five, healthcare capacity near limits, level four, transmissions high, three, epidemic in general circulation, two, transmission low, one, known cases in the UK. Which level do you think we're in at the moment, and how long would you think that we would need to be within these linked tiers if the linked tiers that you suggest in the paper were implemented?
So in terms of the kind of alert levels that we kind of sketch out, they're largely based on the JBC's alert levels, although we've slightly tinkered with the thresholds that they use to try and bring them a bit more into line with what it looks like the government is trying to do. So we, in a sense, ours is an effort. We're not being prescriptive and saying this is the right answer, but we're sort of saying if you try and bring together the alert system that the JBC uses and the government's kind of intention about when it wants to open up, this is broadly how it should fit together if you were to link alerts to measures. We have, and I think the JBC's just reduced the alert level to four, and on our kind of on our grid, the level of infections would have us at a level four at the moment. Now, I can't remember the exact numbers for South East London, the East and the South West, but certainly case numbers are falling relatively quickly. And within a couple of weeks, you can imagine us being in a sort of alert level three in the South, but probably still in four in much of the rest of the country. And, you know, again, don't want to be prescriptive over exactly what actions should accompany these things, but, you know, we were floating the idea that, you know, once you get to that kind of relatively low level of infection, it's possible that you could start easing to non-essential retail in those areas with cases that are running at less than 50 new cases per 100,000 per week. So that it gives you a sense that probably on average the government's reopening strategy is about right for the country, but probably in different areas of the country you could be going faster or slower, given the rates of infection we're seeing.
In terms of vaccination, there has been an argument made by some people who supported Brexit that because the UK has been vaccinating at a swifter rate than the EU, that this proves that Brexit was the right thing to do and that we could only do this outside the European Union, all that kind of thing. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think overall that there's not a lot in that argument, really. There's very little, if anything, that the government couldn't have done within the EU that it ultimately did. But I think there is something to be said for it pointing the way, the success of the strategy, and it was really the strategy that the government and its task force took that was successful in getting ahead of the curve, being good customers, priming the pump, making sure that supply chains were built here, easing the way for trials to be done here. All of those things cleared the path and made it much quicker for us to get authorizations and get rollout in the UK. And I think that's partly because the UK government recognized that it was a relatively small player globally and it had to be nimble and helpful and those kinds of things. And so there's probably a lesson in there about, how we can make a success of the problems that Brexit's created, or at least minimise the downsides of them. But that's not the same as saying that this stuff couldn't have been done within the EU, because it clearly could have done.
In the piece, when you discuss when we're finally getting towards a state of normality, as you mentioned, the idea of some form of international health credential to ensure that people who are travelling abroad, know that they've had the vaccination. And there has been some argument as to whether we should have that domestically, a domestic vaccine passport. How realistic do you think the idea of a domestic vaccine passport would be? And how much do you think, if the government did implement it, it would cost?
Well, it's obviously a big logistical challenge. I think to start with the kind of background to the sort of the government's plans to ease all restrictions in June. I mean, if you look at the modelling that the government government's model has produced alongside the exit plan, you know, they do expect there to be quite a big resurgence in cases and deaths as we open up. Partly because there's going to be a lot of people who aren't vaccinated, including children, and partly because there's, you know, there's still quite a lot of vulnerable people who may succumb to the virus still. So, so there's going to be a lot of questions about, you know, how good is our containment infrastructure, because we're not going to be able to rely solely on the vaccine to stop the virus from spreading. So that's where it kind of, you know, it's almost a natural question that a lot of businesses who are worried about whether their customers are going to come back are going to start to ask, you know, is there a way of helping people or making sure that customers are not putting other customers at risk or staff at risk or whatever. And you know, there are ethical questions around that that we need to consider. So it's difficult to know how this will. So that's one part of the picture. The other part of the picture is internationally, with international travel, it seems increasingly clear that, you know, that this is where we're going to go. Now, I think in terms of some of the ethical questions, if you take the view that there is going to be a kind of bottom-up push, you know, for certain establishments are going to want people to have some sort of credential, and you've got this need for an international, some sort of international system, then it makes sense for government to try to coordinate this and tackle some of the ethical questions. So one of the things we've suggested is that this could be a digital health credential that doesn't mean anybody has to give away any of their own identity to the organisation that's asking for your health credentials, and that also it could include whether people have had, you know, recent negative tests as well, so that people who, for whatever reason, can't have a vaccine, don't want a vaccine, whatever, as long as they are, you know, testing themselves or whatever, and can prove that, then they shouldn't be prevented from accessing the same, you know, services and whatever as everybody else. So I think there's a way of doing this which, if the government takes the lead and designs it well, would coordinate with other countries, but would also coordinate the private sector and limit the ethical problems that arise. In terms of cost, I mean, I'm afraid I can't really speak to that. Obviously, there are we have a lot of infrastructure already available, things like the NHS booking app and things like that, which have been mentioned as possible platforms for some of this stuff. But it's not something that I could comment on about how much that would cost. But I do think that given the challenge we'll face in terms of containing the virus, if we could get this to work, it could be quite effective at saving lives.
In terms of testing, there has obviously, because tests take a certain amount of time, there has been emphasis placed by some, including some in government, on the use of rapid testing, which can, in certain circumstances, not be as effective as other tests. How much do you think we would have to step up rapid testing to make it more effective and to ensure that we are catching people who may potentially have the virus? And do you think that this is something that, you know, we would have the capacity to be able to fully roll out across the country, or is it going to have to only be at particular areas? So, for example, checkpoints coming in and out of the country, airports, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, these things, the testing technology and rapid testing things are improving all the time. And so I think, you know, as we get out of this lockdown, it does seem like a critical component of the solution. It's hard to say whether, you know, how, what the best strategies in terms of rolling them out. I mean, I think government is planning to use them with schools and things like that, and other areas of high contact, probably people coming into the country is another obvious forum in which you would roll these things out. But of course, it's possible to go much further as well. It all depends, I guess, on the effectiveness of them and the cost, and whether or not whether or not certain areas of life are it's more useful to have that kind of capacity to test in than others, and there's going to be some sort of cost effectiveness trade off there. But it's hard to see a world in which they're not at least part of the solution.
Now, in terms of statutory sick pay, there has obviously been a great deal of contention between those who have been attempting to get it and those who have been able to get it, and those who have also been trying to get the £500 self-isolation payment. You mentioned in the piece that the TUC has estimated that 70% of applicants have been rejected. Do you think that there needs to be a more robust system in terms of statutory sick pay and isolation pay to ensure that as restrictions are eased, that we don't potentially see people being forced to go to work who may have symptoms or who are potentially asymptomatic, who could spread the virus around their workplace?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the pandemic should really change our view of the importance of sick pay and things like that, and changing a culture from which people are, it's a good thing to go to struggle into work no matter what, versus one way people can pass on infections like this and actually knock out, you know, many more people from the workforce for a few days. So I think, and one of the things that we've seen is obviously a lot of concern over compliance with isolation measures and requirements, and the idea that maybe people just don't care or whatever, and the reality for a lot of people is that they simply can't afford to, and so I think we need to recognise that financial constraint on complying with the isolation rules is a major one, and you know, those of us lucky enough to work from home don't necessarily appreciate quite how stark that choice is for a lot of people a lot of the time. So I think there's now, with the TUC's figure of 70% of people being rejected from having to claiming the payment, I mean, it's hard to know, you know, obviously what's going on there. You don't know how many of them would or would not have been eligible, but it does seem very surprisingly high rejection rate, which does just point to the fact that, you know, people need financial support if they're going to be able to, self-isolate and put food on the table. And nobody really should be put in the position of having to make that difficult choice.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been great to have you on, Ian. And I have one final question. Throughout this podcast, we've been discussing lockdown, which, as we mentioned, we're currently in. And of course, regardless of the lockdown, because of the pandemic, there are restrictions on what we've been able to do. So when the pandemic is finally resolved and things go back to a state of normal activity, what one thing that you haven't been able to do because of the pandemic are you most looking forward to being able to do again?
Great question. That's so many to choose from, but it's probably going to be having a cold beer in the pub, I think.
I think that's a great choice. It's one that I certainly will be looking forward to, and I think a great deal of our listeners will be as well. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast. If people want to find out more about the paper, more about you, more about the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, where should they go?
Yeah, so if you look at our website, institute.global, then you can find all of our stuff and the report that we've been talking about today. So please do go and have a look and get in touch if you've got comments or suggestions.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Debated Podcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.